Moncrief on News Talk
with Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
It is time for Movies and Booze. I'm pleased to say Tomás Clancy is uninjured, or at least doing very
only my pride.
Yes, and I'm told that Niamh was so startled by Tom's fall, she grabbed Annie's boob. Which is, there you go, yet another case of sexual harassment. Right, so Esther McCarthy is also with us as well. Good afternoon to you both. To start, just on a slightly, on a sad note.
Yeah.
As people know, Simon Fitzmaurice, you were only talking about his film last week, was it, or the week before?
Yeah. And, which is still in cinemas,
which
actually.
Which is still in cinemas.
Noteworthy to say that. It's well worth seeing as well. It's really sad. I suppose it's the potential opportunity he had and the limitless talent he had, really, that we didn't get to see really in the end was quite sad, because he made a couple of short films that got screened at Sundance, including one called The Sound of People, which I think is floating around online today if you get a chance to look at it. And he just had this natural raw talent and endeared himself to another person who sadly left us, including Alan Rickman, who became a friend and a big champion of him and a big supporter of his films when he later became ill. And I know our own Colin Farrell as well, who narrates It's Not Yet Dark, because he thought the talent and achievement that Simon Fitzmaurice has made despite having motor neuron disease in recent years was really exceptional, you know.
Yeah.
The first person in the world with MND to direct a feature film.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He used eye gaze technology on the set of a film called My Name is Emily, starring Ivana Walsh, and communicated with his cast and crew via computer software. That was extraordinary, and they got the film made. It was pretty good as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, my heart goes out to his family today. Now that there's a lot of people in the filmmaking community to be a little bit heartbroken today.
Yeah. I won't imagine. So I suppose there's something in saying that he did get that film finished.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the documentary, as I say, it's Not Yet Dark, is based on his memoir, which was a bestseller. I know a lot of people will be very familiar with that.
Yeah.
Would be a difficult watch this weekend, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But a very poignant one.
Yeah, yeah. Very poignant one. And condolences to his family. And of course, his wife also wrote a best-selling
a super book
about it.
I found my tribe.
Yeah, that is very sad. Anyway, we'll move on. What films are we talking about today?
We have a Marvel comic book gem this week. The new Thor movie is an absolute hoot. It's brilliant. It's really great fun. Directed by a guy by the name of Taika. I'm going to struggle so much with this.
Yeah, I told you before about your Icelandic. It's really pathetic.
He's from New Zealand. He is zany as hell. I had the pleasure of interviewing him recently. And that zaniness finds its way up to the big screen. And who knew that comic book movies could be this much fun, and we didn't have to sit through so much angst and daddy issues and origin and backstory, and we could have just been having a laugh all along.
Yeah. The thing is, though, this was bound to happen sooner or later, because, you know, it had become boring. It had become predictable. It had become trite. So the only real way to go was to inject a large amount of comedy into it. But now that they've injected comedy into it, it's probably very difficult to go back.
And where do you go from here?
Yeah, and then it'll eventually just eat itself, the entire franchise.
Well, that's the danger. Look, credit to Marvel and credit to Disney for seeing that this had the potential. If they're going to make so many comic book movies, which they are, and tie up that universe with so many different strands and characters popping in and out of each other's films, to at least pick a director who's a bit, you know, left field and a bit off kilter, and to do something new and inventive with it. And it's worked wonderfully well, I have to say, in this instance. So we'll have more of those, please.
Okay, yeah. Great. And the other film is Breathe.
Breathe, yeah. Strangely, having just spoken about Simon Fitzmaurice, this is another story of someone who lived an inspirational life with a disability. It was a guy called Robin Cavendish, who developed polio in the 1950s or early 60s. An Englishman, and kind of went on to, he ended up being attached to an iron lung and really fighting to find a will to live, but for the sake of his family, he not only did that, but lived very unconventionally, travelled the world with a, you know, on a wing and a prayer a lot of the time, with the help of an inventor friend who kind of attached the iron lung to a buggy, and off he went and discovered the world, and I suppose changed how people of that generation and that era were expected to live as well. So it's quite sweet, Andrew Garfield playing the character of Cavendish.
And interestingly, directed by Andy Serkis.
Yes, yes. It's his directorial debut in the... Yeah, it's just... He's such an interesting guy, Serkis, because, you know, he's kind of changed how actors perform by doing those two great performance motion capture roles, Gollum and of course,
Planet of the Apes,
which he's just brilliant in. And now off he is at the other end of the camera, trying to direct as well. So.
Yeah, but then he was on Graham Norton there a while in back, and he was showing the difference between the way different apes walk.
Yeah.
And even in doing that, it was pretty clear that really only Andy Serkis can do this kind of thing properly.
Did you see when he did it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is quite extraordinary. So it's people might be trying to ape, pardon the pun, Andy Serkis and those kind of performances. Very difficult to
do. He's unique.
Yeah.
Yeah, he sure is.
Very, very talented guy indeed. What a brilliant, fun, brilliant, lovely film My Name is Emily is. Anyone trying to find their way back to their children should see this.
Yeah,
it
is. It's about it's Evanna Lynch is very good in the lead, actually, and it is about her relationship with her father to some extent, and there's a little love story in it as well.
Yeah.
It is very sweet.
Can you tell me where I can get Lindair Rosé or Brute Sparkling Wines? Having lived in New Zealand for a few years, I loved it. I am unable to find it in Ireland.
There should be some in. Some of the places like Sweeney's in Clontarf, you might find it there. And you might also find it in Redmond's of Ranelagh. So it's in Specialist Independence. There's a few. There's a couple that certainly used to import it anyway.
Yeah. So today we're talking about Chardonnay.
Chardonnay. We're doing ABC. We're just, you know, one, we're doing the strike back. Anything but Chardonnay brigade. We want to sort of overthrow them. And we want to restore Chardonnay to the centrepiece, to the forefront of our white wine interest and love. It's all about sweetness and joy, and, you know, accepting that we can be happy with wine, that we don't have to sort of counterbalance, you know, this kind of puritanical sort of idea that it should be tart and crisp and sour if we wanted to, you know, if we want to counterbalance the sort of the horrors of actually enjoying it. Why not have something that's mellifluous and soft and luscious and gorgeous and honeyed and toasty? And so there was a big problem with Chardonnay. We will testify. We will admit it. It did happen. They went a bit too far with wood. And so a lot of particularly...
You better specify what you mean by that.
They went a little too far with oak.
Yeah.
But maybe even they went a bit too far with trying to get oak flavours in Australian wines in particular. There was a very famous French court case which charged people with putting wood chips into wine. And the judgment said that in France, we put, I won't do the accent, but the accent is very good for it. Yeah. It's almost drawn to it. In France, we put the wine into the wood. We don't put the wood into the wine.
Right.
And so what happened was in Australia, they started, it's cheaper to bring staves and dust, oak dust and oak bits and bobs, down to Australia rather than bring barrels, which are big, empty sort of bits of space.
Yeah.
So they started bringing those down, and basically they constructed giant tea bags filled with this, and then put them into vats and then squeezed them up and down, dunked them a few times, and they got a lovely, you know, oaky flavour out of it. The problem is that while it was quite okay for the first sort of, you know, sort of few years, eventually that oak taste became stronger and stronger and stronger. And it's a bit like tea. If you just leave the tea bag in there too long,
yeah,
it just becomes overwhelming, and that's all you get is the tannic sort of taste of it. And then people sort of riposted against that and started looking for lean, clean, well-made white wines elsewhere. Sauvignon Blanc stepped in to fill that gap. Then Pinot Grigio and Grüner-Wertlinger and all kinds of other things today. But Albarino has become the white wine of fashion. But great Chardonnay producers all over the world have readjusted, and they've come back and they've tried to make good, rich, interesting wines, but aren't too oaky, but that are a little bit generous and a little bit charming. And so we have two today. We have one from California, from the Russian River Valley, from Sonoma, in fact, from very close to where all these fires were the week before last. And we have one from the Languedoc, sort of the crescent between Marseille and Barcelona, that is now occupied by a bit of France. So,
okay, lovely stuff there. We had an amazing wine called Gentle Giant from the Haute Espora Vineyard, vineyard in Franschhoek. Any idea if anyone brings it to Ireland?
No, I don't think they do. The best place to try it is to look up Kinniger Wines, who are a specialist South African importer in Galway. So Kinniger Wines, I think, .ie, and have a look there and scout through. But I don't think they are imported. South African wine has fallen off the table, literally, over the last few years. After the fall of apartheid and the rise of Mandela into power, everyone was fascinated and went and bought it all, and then what they got was Long Mountain and rather modest wines that were very similar and rather dull, and Pinotage, which really smelled like the kind of at that particular time the kind of plaster that you'd put on burns in the old days, you know, that you take out of the tin box and slime it onto your hand. You get that kind of violets and iodine kind of smell, and everyone eventually said, you know, we've done our bit politically, we've supported them, and now they stop buying them. And that's really it. That's what's kind of happened to it. But they've restored. And there was also a tiny, tiny, tiny thing that an awful lot of the wineries, many of the wineries, were of the kind of the strong white background.
Yes.
And a lot of them were Afrikaans, but no matter where they were not at the forefront of the ANC.
Yes.
So let's put it that way, I suppose, from a land-earning and political perspective. So there was a slight, after the initial rush, there was a slight pullback.
Yeah.
And now what we've got is we've got, you know, a generation and a half onwards from that, and you've got young people beginning to be farming in all these kind of areas, doing all the kind of exciting things that they do in America and Australia and so forth. So it will come back, but for the moment, you've got to go to specialists at the moment.
Right. I read something about a wine crisis in the papers this week, something about the weather or frost or something. Can Tomás reassure me that this isn't the case?
It is the case, but we can reassure you that there's enough wine to go around. Don't panic.
Okay.
That's all we can say. But this year, the summer in France was, and the summer across Europe was absolutely appalling, with, hail at the beginning, which knocked out all the flowers, then dry patches, then low-slung, sunless months with plenty of rain, which is not what they expect in Burgundy. I just went down there and laughed and said, you should try coming and doing this in, you know, sort of in Leash or Offaly, and then tell us about the fact that you don't see. They complained about not seeing enough of the blue sky. But there, it's a reduction rather than the elimination of it, and it's reduced the crop. So, but not to worry, there's plenty of other places making wine.
It wouldn't affect the price?
It'll affect the price tremendously. You are looking, Bordeaux and Burgundy. I'm afraid that's the way it always goes. It's a happiness, you know, it's an unhappiness for the farmer. They would like to sell a lot of crops.
Yeah.
But if they can't sell a lot of crops, they'll sell a little of it for a big price. So Burgundy wines, Bordeaux wines, Alsace, they're in 2017 will be synonymous with, and I can almost write the PR press releases that will be coming out in about a 2 months' time, which will be that despite the tremendous weather and the low crop, they managed to pull out a brilliant vintage from 2017. I wouldn't believe it until I taste it, to be honest.
Yeah. Does that mean that 2017 wine will be known as a bad year?
It'll be known as when the PR gets going, it'll be known as a brilliant year, saved by fantastic winemaking that they managed to get it. But that's what'll happen. I think it'll be a green and low volume year. Yeah. So
right.
I'll avoid it.
Someone else says, I've lost that one. Anyway, somebody was just trying to plug their off-license business, basically. My mum and I are heading down to Cork from Monaghan. We just love listening to your show. We loved your response to the guy who was outraged by the RT presenters. Hashtag haters gonna hate. Also, please give a shout out to my mum, Maggie in the Woods. So, hello, Maggie in the Woods there. Though not everyone agrees with me. T is texting in to say I'm 100% with Noel on this blatant reverse sexism from RTE. But it's good that people are standing up for middle-aged white guys who are, of course, the most oppressed minority in the country. Of course, me, as a black 23-year-old, I'm unaware of that. I'm so privileged. Back in a couple of minutes. 1850 453 106 is our local number. Our text number is 53106. It will cost you 30 cents. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter or send us an email to afternoon@newstalk.com. This day week, we will be broadcasting. That's Friday, the 3rd of November. We'll be broadcasting from the Open Gate Brewery at St. James's Gate in Dublin. That's to celebrate the the Stout Festival that's taking place that week. Now, if you'd like to come along and be part of the audience, then you just have to log on to newstalk.com/Moncrief Dublin. newstalk.com/Moncrief Dublin. Of course, places are limited, etc., etc. So get in there as quick as you can. And we will be sampling their limited edition brew, Stout of This World. It's going to be fantastic, don't you know. Tomás and Esther are still with us, of course, for Movies and Booze. Rory in Wicklow wants to know, I have heard that some winemakers scorch the inside of oak barrels to add a smoky flavour to the oaked wine. Is this true?
It's absolutely true, and it's done by and it's done by all barrel makers these days. And what you do is you buy your barrels and you talk about what is called the toast, the interior toast. Mm. And it was an accident, because to make a barrel, you put the stave, the wooden stave, you spray it with a bit of water, and then you heat up the stave, and that makes it bendable, and you can bend the staves in to make the barrel shape. And what happened was, different coopers would, you know, there'd be a guy who'd be real slow making it. So it'd be 3 hours with this fire in front of it, and his barrels would always be kind of blackened a bit. But then when you put wine into his barrel, it came out with this lovely sort of, you know, buttery, smoky tone. Mm. And then guys who were really quick, or ladies who were really quick, they would have less of a toast on it, less burned, and it would get a sort of creamy flavour. So nowadays, you ring up the barrel maker and you say, I would like toast number one, which is very light, or toast number four, which is very scorched on the inside.
Ah, right. Okay. Can you ask your drinks guru this, please? When on holidays in Italy, we were drinking a bottle of red wine in the hotel, and it was lovely. It was called Rotule Toscana Siligiolo, something like that. Can you recommend anyone similar that we can get over here, please? I'm not a big wine drinker, but this was lovely. Okay, I'm just going to show that to you there.
Right.
Does that make sense to you, that name there?
Siligiolo. No, it doesn't. I'd have to say that looks to me like looks very like a Tuscan, a super Tuscan, which just simply these days means a wine from Tuscany that is not made with Sangiovese, is made with a few other different things.
Ah.
However, what you're looking at from Tuscany is obviously Chianti is the main driver. That's what we tend to have an awful lot of, and you have to go to the specialist wine shops to get the kind of the slightly other sort of production from the Tuscan region. You might not ever get that. A lot of Italian wine never travels further than the village it's made in. the late great Paolo Tullio was often away with him, and he would show you a wine and say, the great thing about this is nobody in the village over the hill will have ever heard of this wine. Never mind in Rome, and never mind in Dublin. So you could well be on that line, and I would say that.
What's your opinion on the quality of the wine shipped in bulk from Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, then bottled in the UK? Have stayed away from these wines and gone for wines bottled at the vineyard?
Well, I obviously, I'm torn. It seems to me that the future is definitely going to be in bulk transportation, because it's the green, sustainable, carbon neutral way to do it. And it's the way it was done in the past. Barrel transportation is bulk transportation. Mm. They put it into barrels to bring it over to us, and it was always bottled by local bottlers. So Mitchell and Sons in Dublin 250 years ago, they would have bottled Lafitte and Latour, and everybody bottled in their own country, because everybody thought it was insane to have expensive heavy glass bottles with, you know, sort of 75 centilitres in it. So 3/4 of a pint in a bottle like that. You bring up a barrel with 50 pints and then bottle it there.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's the way forward. What we need to see is them getting better about the way in which they transport it, and they are. So over the last 10 or 15 years, they've invented more and more exquisite, neutral interiors for these boats, and they pressure and temperature control them as they transport them, and then they bottle them here. If it's done well, there is really no need not to. The reason that the caller might be anxious, the texter might be anxious, is because in the past it was very much the case that the only wines you did that with were cheap. nonsense.
Right, okay.
And what we're going to see is increasingly good quality wines taking this carbon neutral, green and sustainable approach.
Can you get Tempest 2 wines from Hunter Valley anywhere here?
They were in Tesco's. This is part of the McGuigan. It's the McGuigan that's the... It's the daughter, McGuigan daughter, who I've interviewed McGuigan, who's an Irish fellow, Neil McGuigan. Mm. Well, Irish, their ancestors left here in the early 19th century.
Okay, when you say left
well, it's not. It's really a little open as to whether they bought the passage or it was bought for them.
Ah, I see. Okay.
But they ended up over there anyway. So yeah, it was in Tesco's. If you have a look around, you might see some old stock there.
Jer says, I was in Nice recently, ooh, and had a meal in the worst restaurant there. This was not intentional. God, that's some achievement though. As we couldn't use the loos, we went around the corner after. We went into a fairly ordinary looking cafe and thought we get a glass of wine too. The waiter brought out two bottles and gave us the price. Me, thinking I knew my French, chose the least expensive. Imagine our surprise when he brought out a carafe and started smelling the cork, etc. It was then I realised that I'd got Vingt Quatre mixed up. I'd chosen the €84 bottle of wine. I nearly died, but it was absolutely delicious. Chateau Cassara 200 from Lebanon. Can I die happy now?
Well, no, it's a very good wine and, you know, you've chosen very well. It's available in Ireland. And
84 quid?
No, considerably less.
You were in Nice, Ger. Yes.
You might pay around, say, €29 in shops for that now.
God.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, you can't die happy. Sorry, Ger. Did Esther go to see Killing of a Sacred Deer premiere? I saw some pictures on Twitter of that young actor at it. I'm really excited about seeing this one. Does she know when it's out?
It's out next week. I went last night to the premiere, yeah, because I decided it wasn't mad enough for me and I had to go and have a second viewing.
Yes.
It's absolutely brilliant. It's a director and writer by the name of Yorgos Lanthimos, who Irish people would be quite familiar with because he made The Lobster. Randomly down in Parknesilla in County Kerry, decided to base the production there with Colin Farrell and Rachel Weisz and all kind of mad filming locations like Blanchardstown Shopping Centre and Joel's Restaurant on the Long Mile Road even gets a look in. So he kind of has this real absurdist kind of approach where he puts people in kind of mad situations and then expects them to respond. So as you'll have seen in The Lobster, there were, you know, it was a big kind of satire, I suppose, on singletons by turning them into animals if they didn't mate and find a partner. It was absolutely hilarious. This new one is much darker, but I was delighted at the premiere last night to find people tittering the whole way through, that there were plenty of people with pitch black humour in my company last night in the lighthouse. And it's about, and again, it's an incredible breakout performance from Barry Keoghan, who plays this young troubled lad, two Irish actors in it this time, Colin Farrell again, and Barry Keoghan, who plays this troubled young man who kind of visits this family with very, very sinister results. And everyone came out last night. Barry was there and having a great time, and everyone came out going, this guy is going to go boom because he's absolutely brilliant in the film. It's a very memorable and very potent kind of performance. And he's going to be in the new Brad Layton film as well. Do you remember a documentary a couple of years ago called The Imposter? I don't know if you ever saw it, where a guy came back into the lives of this family whose kid was missing and pretended to be the kid all grown up. And it was an actual a movie a few years ago.
Oh, wow.
It was a really original film. It's brilliant. Like, you'd see it on Netflix now if you haven't seen it already. It was kind of partly drama, partly documentary, and it was a really stunning piece of work. And Barry is now going to be in that director's next film, which is about a big bank heist in America. So he is really going places at the
okay,
moment.
Okay, good.
Very
for
exciting.
Good for him. And but Killing of a Sacred Deer is probably still in that kind of Marmite category that you kind of get
Totally, nuts. Yeah. I brought the hubby last night and I was looking out my side eye the whole time going, am I going to get lynched at the end of this or not? But he really liked it, actually.
The hashtag is Halloween movies, ghouls rush in, the big Lebowski, and 10 things I hate about, for instance. This, I this seems to come up regularly now. Tom says, can you ask Esther what she thought about About Time, starring Donald Gleeson? I watched it recently, and although being a red-blooded male, I was bawling crying at the end.
It's one of those films that either leaves people a bit cold or reduces them to wailing wrecks, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was left a bit cold by it. This has come up a bit lately, hasn't it?
It must
be on TV or something again recently.
Yeah.
It left me a bit cold. Not the ending, not the little twist of the ending with Bill Nighy. I found that very moving. But before that, it was all just a bit too... What's that director's name again? His name's just gone completely...
Richard Curtis, yeah.
Richard Curtis-y for me.
Yeah, it's nice. There's nothing unpleasant about it. And you'd like to live in that land.
Nice is the word, actually. Yeah. Nice is the problem. Everyone has nice hair and they have nice, sensible jumpers and nice friends.
And fabulous apartments in very expensive parts of London. Yeah.
And it's just a bit, it's a bit cut.
It was Martin's off-license that somebody was texting in about before, and Mick Corcoran says, I shop there, I don't work there, and they have a great selection of wines and beers. Okay, Mick, fair enough. And someone else says, finally, woohoo, you're talking about Chardonnay. It's my favourite white wine, buttery grown-up deliciousness. It's gotten a bad rap. I ordered it in the pub the other night and the barman looked at me dead in the eyes and said, are you sure? So, are we sure, Tomas?
Oh, we're sure. We're very, very sure. I mean, the real thing here, and it's, you know, what annoys me tremendously is that at the very top of the tree in wine, Montrachet, Pouligny-Montrachet, Meursault, all of these really super expensive wines that are sort of 400-600 euros a bottle to begin with, they're all made from Chardonnay. The great Chablis is Chardonnay as well. So all of these great wines that the kind of elite wine community love are made from Chardonnay, and yet they denigrate anything that's got the word Chardonnay written on the front of the bottle. So in some ways, I think it's helped them. They don't want too many people to have been interested in Chardonnay in some way, shape or form, and they can it suits people to eliminate Chardonnay from the portfolio. But and I suppose it stops me saying every week, this tastes like a very good, well-priced Pouligny-Montrachet. So this first wine that we have today is called Pacific Heights, and it's Chardonnay. So it's from the Pacific Heights Winery. It's the Pacific Heights Chardonnay from Russian River Valley, 2015. It's available in Marks and Spencer's, who've made a big effort in the last few months to try and elevate their wine selection and to match the kind of ambition they have in a lot of their sort of foods and so forth. So that's what that means in reality is this wine is $23.50. So they're not trying to find a wine that's 8 euros. They're looking at a wine that's they're willing to put this out there. I suppose we'll see whether people go ahead and buy them at this price from them, but it's a very good wine.
And it's a lovely wine.
What they've done is they've gone instead of the kind of the looking at multiples or looking at giant sort of corporations, they've tried the same approach which has been successful for the German imports that we talked about before, and in fact we've another wine today from Aldi. And so they've also tried to go and find just offbeat people and see if they've got enough wine to put it out in the shelves for now, knowing that they won't be able to fill them for the full 365 days a year. And I think a lot of what will happen here is that I think Chardonnay could be a very good sort of tool for the supermarkets to use in this particular new way. Supermarkets are almost on the verge of being a past form of purchasing, because we're seeing, you see, there's been a downturn in several of the sort of UK supermarkets in terms of how they're doing, how well they're doing, because their whole margin has been about where they put the wine or the cheese or the milk in the supermarket and paying for displaying in every corner of it. So if you want to have a product sold well, you want it on the third shelf up beside your eye. And that's where they get extra. Their supernormal profits come from these kind of deals that they do to get the product into the supermarkets. With people buying online, it's all gone. So that idea of getting money from having it placed, or worrying about shop placements where you've got the bread at the back to draw people in and make sure the milk is in the middle of nowhere, so you go through 95 aisles of other stuff where you might have snatch purchases before you get down to milk. All that art and science of supermarkets is just, and the value that was added to that, is evaporating in front of them. So what they are now, you know, starting to do is they're starting to bring in those kind of niche products that smaller shops have been working on for years, and this is one of these. So Marks and Spencer's have now got themselves a very interesting range of fascinating wines. This one, Russian River Valley Chardonnay. So this is California. California hot, very hot. And as we know from the last two or three weeks, prone to fire, prone to wildfires, which have destroyed anything. The figures are enormous, but they're talking between 15 and maybe even 30% of the vineyard country of California has been subject to these fires, to say nothing of hundreds of people dead and, you know, billions of pounds worth of product lost. This is from those counties, near those counties, Sonoma and Napa, but up near the coast, about 100 kilometers north of San Francisco. If you know San Francisco and the Bay and you think about it there, 100 straight north, and you're going through redwood forest. This is where all the huge redwood trees, and going to, eventually you come to a kind of a gap, and it's the next big sort of inlet after the sort of California, San Francisco Bay, and that is the Russian River Bay. And this is called the Russian River Bay because Russians went there. The Russian explorers coming down the coast, and this is one of the places they stopped in to look at. They were very interested in fur, and they were fur trappers. So this is a big forest teeming with wildlife, covered in fur, and so very attractive to Russians, apparently. So the Russians, the fur, and the beavers, and all these other furry animals are in there. And in 1849, when they struck gold up at the bottom of the Silverado Trail north of all this, then suddenly all the people from San Francisco washed through this area, and they stopped off in various places, founding the wineries. That's where all the wineries come from. And then they took over this area. Its advantage over Napa and Sonoma, even, but particularly even Napa, is that it's so close to the coast that a sort of a mini micro sort of ecosystem has formed, where fog comes up the river valley, comes up the river, and settles from, you know, very late in the evening right through till about 11 or 12 in the following day. You'll be sitting there in fog, thick, wettish, cool fog.
Yeah, and San Francisco is weird like that, in that it's so un-Californian. It's more like Ireland.
It's completely strange. But then at 11:47, boomf, the fog just disappears and goes home. And then you've got bright, unrestricted, completely clear blue sky, which is very unnerving for anyone from Ireland. And this is where they're making it. So you've got lovely, lovely temperate weather, rather than baked, heavy baked sort of weather in the interior. And you get these kind of this, which is a very silky, smooth, creamy toned Chardonnay. But it doesn't have, it's not too hot, and it doesn't have too much woody characteristic at the end of it. It's not burnished with oak, and hasn't had an accident in a lumber yard. It kind of finishes easily into a kind of a creamy, delicious, sort of more apricotish kind of finish to it. And you've got those kind of creamy tones in the middle, which are the honey and nut tones that people do like in a nice Chardonnay. It's a super beast. And one for a weekend, you know, for a Sunday lunch, €23.50, and you could have happiness, and it might draw you back to Chardonnay.
It's actually really nice. It's really, really nice. Can you ask your man if you can buy Bordolino wine in Ireland? Had it in Lake Garda last year, and it was sweet to the beat. Not actually sweet. Also, I agree with no. You're getting in a bit of, you know, reverse sexism there.
Yeah, you can. Well, you said sidestepping the sexism. That's not the you can part.
Yeah.
As you can't. But Bordolino wines are available, and you can get, there's a Zanato version of it, which Searson's wine out in Monkstown will have. And I think it's in Galway, and Woodbury's in Galway have it as well. And you'll find them in shops all over the country. Bordolino, it's out there. It is out there. It's a lovely wine from Lake Garda.
Yeah. Someone says that Chardonnay at M&S is in Jerry Adams's €30 wine budget. It is indeed. So good news for Jerry as well. Terry from Santa Rita Estates was on to give you a slapping. Tomás is not fully correct on the bulk question. The energy is used on the bottle production rather than the freight. However, he is correct that bulk supply is getting better, says Terry. Terry, then again, if they use all the energy on the bottle production, it doesn't matter where they're doing it, they're still making bottles.
But then you add in the cost of shipping all those made bottles.
Yeah.
So no, I would reject Mr. Pennington's statement and suggest that what we have here is a reduction in the carbon the account and in the green energy or in the energy exported or expended in bringing those bottles from Australia back up here. Far better to make them if we actually discount the cost of making the bottles, because if they're made in Britain or in Germany and distributed in Britain, Germany or Ireland, then we've got a lower, you know, the lower reductive cost of the actual transportation. Whereas if we make them in Australia and then put them onto a ship and transport all that glass up he says. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's gonna weigh more. It's going to use more energy, yes, because the bottles are being made anyway. Yeah. So
we're not saying there's no energy expended, but we substantially reduce it by getting rid of the glass at one end.
Yeah. If Terry says though that it's the making the bottles that produces the energy, well, that's either happening here or there. So that's going to happen anyhow.
It will happen anyway. And what we're talking about is the cost of transportation of the heavy bottle.
Yeah. Terry's sorry. Now he takes it in. Because we totally trashed his argument. Martin says, just love it when some smart arse Dublin 4 type texts in an obscure wine name, hoping to impress the wine buff. And then he says, yes, it's available in Tesco's. Favourite bit of the show, says Martin. On that subject, Paul in Galway says, I had a beautiful fruity red wine when I was in the foothills of the Pyrenees. I can't remember the name, but I think it begins with a C. Oh, yeah, we know the one, but we're not going to tell you what it was. All of a sudden, everyone's talking about the lobster like it was the best thing ever. Okay, it was watchable. And Rachel is always divine. But when it first came up on Netflix, it caused zero fuss. And no one I mentioned it to had ever heard of it. The Emperor's New Clothes come to mind.
Absolutely not. The Lobster was a great film. But it was a film that people found because it was an obscure film director from Greece who had made a name for himself with his first two films. But he was making a film in the English language for the first time. So lots of people weren't really familiar with his work. But The Lobster did very well, very good box office here. I think it's probably the fact that it was filmed here was probably drew people in and drew their interest.
Yeah.
Can
you ask Esther if you should see Ragnarok if you haven't seen any other Thor movies? Carl wants to know.
Yeah, you could just go and see it as a comedy and forget it, even thinking about it as part of the Marvel Universe. It's just absolutely hilarious.
Enjoy
it on its own basis.
Would you like to talk about that movie first?
For sure.
Okay,
yeah.
We're talking about Thor coming up after this.
Okay, I thought the world of you. I thought we were going to fight side by side forever, but at the end of the day, you're you and I'm me. I know maybe there's still good in you, but let's be honest, our paths diverged a long time ago.
Yeah. It's probably for the best that we never see each other again.
That's what you always wanted. Hey, let's do get help.
What?
Get help.
No.
Come on, you love it.
I hate it.
It's great. It works every time.
It's humiliating.
Do you have a better plan?
No.
We're doing it.
We are not doing get help.
Get help! Please! My brother's dying! Get help! Help him!
Oh, classic.
Still hate it? It's humiliating.
No, not for me, it's not.
There you go. That's a clip from Thor or Ragnarok. What is Ragnar? Is that their surname?
No,
what does it mean?
It's the destruction of everything, really. It's the end of days. It's doom for the world and all the other planets.
Isn't it always? is that what Ragnarok means?
Yeah, it's an original Norse god term. A lot of the terminology for these films comes from the original terms. And it is when all the gods meet these very powerful, fantastical creatures and have a big war.
The usual.
I love that you played that clip because it's one of the funniest scenes in the film, but it's also, it was made up by Chris Hemsworth, who improvised that whole scene. And I was talking to the director, Taika Waititi. I'm only going to go first name from now on with that, okay?
Okay, but well done. You made him sound like he's from Honolulu.
He's from New Zealand. And, you know, made a couple of indie movies that really got people's attention. It was like he did a vampire mockumentary a few years ago called exactly
about time, yeah.
called What We Do in the Shadows, in which he also starred. Actually, he's a guy who would have had a bigger career as an actor than a director when he was younger. But then last year he made a wonderful film called Hunt for the Wilder People with Sam Neill about this rebellious kid and his uncle who go missing in the bush, and the people, everyone tries to find him. And it was just like, if you see one offbeat Southern Hemisphere movie this year, make it this one. And people really found it and fell in love with it.
Okay, yeah.
Disney went, we need to reboot Thor a bit. The second one was a bit, took itself a bit seriously. We need to have a bit of a laugh. Let's talk to this guy. He met with them and he said, given that these movies are about a Viking god who lives in outer space, I think we should have a bit more fun with it. And that's what they're doing here. Yeah. They're just, you know, it's so great. They're making the most of Chris Hemsworth and Mark Ruffalo's natural comic talents. It feels really improvised. I had the pleasure of meeting the director last week, who I think made every film journalist in Ireland smile over the course of the weekend with his wacky carry-on. He's as colourful in real life as the films that he makes. I know Serena had the pleasure of doing a public interview with him last week, in which he came in and kicked over his chair and sat on the floor, and she just went with the flow, I think, with that one, and it was great fun, apparently. But yeah, so he's just having a bit of fun. The scenes feel improvised in the sense that, as he explained to me, they're not just making stuff up on the spot. You know, you can't go into a 100 million budget odd movie and start making things up.
No.
So what they were doing was a lot of working off the script. But how can we
riffing
make this,
around it? Yeah.
How can we make this better? Let's give loads of options here for the editors to figure out later what works and what doesn't. And they had an absolute blast, including that scene. There is one stage where he has a big face-off with another monster, and he doesn't know until he comes into the stadium to have a fight, do battle with him, that it's the Hulk, basically, who he explains is a friend from work, is how he describes him. So it's all that kind of stuff, you know. They form a little band together to try and take on
the actual plot is
So if you thought Loki was bad, basically, who's Thor's adopted brother, you haven't met their sister yet.
Right, okay. So, oh, and this is Cate Blanchett.
Cate Blanchett, yeah. Who they've turned into a complete goth.
Cool.
Absolutely cool as hell. Like, she's just having a ball here, and she's really good. She has inherited the same powers from her father as the two boys have, of course. And she is very nasty, and she has been locked away by their dad for many years because he used to run the universe with an iron fist, with her by his side, starting wars all over the place, you know, blasting everybody. And he had a change of heart, this Anthony Hopkins, of course, character. He had a change of heart years before and decided he was going to be a benevolent god and make peace. And she lost the head over this entirely. So she was put away in exile and locked away. But
if you're a god, who do you have wars with?
Yeah, you think you just go, no, I said,
I'm God. So
it's
you can't have a war with
okay?
me. Yeah.
But she, so she's back on the scene because he has passed away and threatening hell and damnation, very cross indeed. And it's up to Thor and Loki. He has to actually work with Loki, his hated brother, Tom Hiddleston, in this one, to try and set up a group of people called the Revengers.
Yes.
Get it? and kind of wage an all-out war against this woman, and because she's threatening to not only destroy other universes, but their own universe, which is Asgard.
Okay.
So it's not going to end well for anybody, basically.
So does none of this take place on Earth then? Because Earth is presumably a backwater.
It's in and out of Earth, like the other Thor films. Yeah,
okay.
It's in and out of Earth. But a lot of it is set in the in that universe, actually, this time around. But yeah, Cate Blanchett doing great goth. But I think the film is close to being stolen by an actress by the name of Tessa Thompson, who plays a warrior who joins forces with the Hulk and Thor here. And she's absolutely brilliant in it. I fell a little bit in love with her, if truth be known.
Right, okay. And so, her character is called what?
Her character's name is, I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but she basically is kind of a flight commander who does a lot of the flying and
okay.
shooting. And
so are we going to see her now in other Avengers
movies or yes, various
exactly.
superhero.
She's a new, yeah, she's a new character.
Another one.
Yeah, there is that. There is that.
The wages bills on these films must be enormous.
Absolutely.
So
and I mean, they're making too many of them, end of, full stop. But I really like where they're going with this one because it is really, really good fun. It's very entertaining. I would say it's not the best. It's not the funniest Marvel movie I've seen this year. I would say it's the funniest comedy, full stop, I've seen this year.
Okay.
So it's now, for the people who take their comic book stuff seriously, it's not being disrespectful to the material.
Yeah.
It's just taking it to the next degree and having a whole lot of fun with it. Hemsworth, who you rightfully mentioned, was one of the best things about the Ghostbusters movie, is just having a blast here. Natural comedic actor.
Mm.
And it's just really good fun. Really good fun. And you know, it feels like it's made by people who care about making great entertainment movies, and its heart is in a good place, I think I would say.
Okay, well,
it.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
Somebody says, I remember when your man Chris Hemsworth played Kim in Home and Away. His mullet was magnificent. Now he's a huge Hollywood star. It would be like someone from Fair City starring in Superman.
yeah.
Well, Gabriel Byrne
did
have a kind of a soapy background. Speaking of Thor, did you see Jeff Goldblum? Is Jeff Goldblum
there's
in
two
it?
Great. Yeah, I was just about getting to that, actually. Two other great surprises. Jeff Goldblum is this kind of character known as Grandmaster, who runs this kind of space between two planets, for want of a better way of putting it.
Isn't that just called space, the space between two planets?
No, it's kind of in between the two worlds.
Oh, you mean the two kind of universes?
Yeah. And that's what I meant. Sorry.
Yes.
You'd need a map and charts for some of this stuff, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
But he is allowed. The important thing is he's allowed to go full Jeff Goldblum. He is like wearing pink and yellow, and it's all like colorful. And he has a party place, but it's really. It's kind of a shiny dictatorship that he's running. It's all sparkly and fun, but if you don't go along with him, then you get crushed pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And he is having an absolute blast. The other brilliant element is, again, from the director. He just uses his New Zealand accent to such comedic effect. He's voicing this character called Korg, Korg is a kind of creature made of rock who, you know, bemoans the fact that he tried to start a revolution, but he didn't print enough pamphlets, is how he explains it. And he's just this cheerful New Zealander, that voice. And it's even, you know, he's in awful peril. He's imprisoned. He's about to die, but he's got this cheerful voice. And it's just played for so many laughs. More, please. I would happily have this director do all the other Marvel movies, but I like where they're going into the left field with it.
John Limerick says that clip from Thor sounded like Made in Chelsea with leather and swords. I can't get on board with anything that Tom Hiddleston fella does ever since that whole hot mess with Taylor Swift. You have to separate those things. Did I catch a whiff of you fancying Kate Blanchett? No.
You do.
Did you see Jeff Goldblum and Graham Norton last week? Such a weird, charming man. He was as pleased as punch talking about his contortionist wife. And sure, no wonder. She's half his age. And a contortionist. Two very good points, it must be said. The Lobster. Go back to the Lobster movie. The Lobster was off. 3 hours I'll never get back, says Tony in Cork. Anyway, we've one more movie, one more glass of wine to have after this break. 53106 is our text number that will cost you 30 cents. We've already had a lovely Chardonnay. We've talked about the new Thor movie. We've read out some of the hashtags. They are Halloween movies at the moment. Scare Misty for me being the first one that I can see right in front of me. They are particularly excellent today. Is Thor too scary for a 12-year-old, Mags wants to know.
No, absolutely not. There's a couple of big battle scenes towards the end, but nothing they wouldn't see on the telly.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you ask your wine guy about orange wine? I drank one recently, but find them hard to source.
They are hard to source. These are wines which are white wines that are left on skins. They're macerated on skins so that white wine, to get a white wine, you crush the grape and you get the juice out of it very quickly and you put it straight into stainless steel tank or into a barrel. So the skin doesn't touch it. So you just get this clear wine that we like, which we call white wine. If you throw in the skins with it, you get this kind of orange, kind of amber hue. They are now the most fashionable in the world.
Mm.
And you get them in, you know, in restaurants, all Nomu, Michelin star. If you're going to a Michelin star restaurant, you will find some orange wine on the list. But if you don't do that, look for Le Cave lecavo.ie or lecavo in Kilkenny. They have the largest selection. Green Man up in Tirrenure.
Okay, look, let's move on to our second Chardonnay then.
Okay, this one is Domaine Paul Mass, and it's the Estelia Chardonnay from Limoux. It's available in Aldi and it's $10.99. And this is a very interesting development again from Aldi. The Estelia is actually named for the daughters of Jean-Claude Mass, who runs this winery, Astrid, Elia, Apollinae, and Estelle. So that's their all four
cool
of their names.
Cool names, anyway.
Very cool names. The bottle itself, I think, if Terry's still listening, this would be the heaviest bottle I've
ever. That would be a heavy bottle.
It is incredibly heavy. This is a carbon offence. As I sit it in my hand,
there are members that bottle killed about four polar bears.
It did. There are members of the Green Party weeping each time they walk past them. It is a beautiful, beautiful, heavy
weight
bottle. It is
actually lovely.
It's rather gorgeous and has a nice mottled sort of top, which is simulating sort of grapes, I think, as part of its charm. This is from Limoux. So Limoux is in the Languedoc. And the Languedoc, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about wine of Catalan, soon to be Catalan Republic.
Yes.
So just above the Catalan Republic is Roussillon and Languedoc. And the Roussillon part is the part that's a little bit Spanish, a little Catalan. And then just above that is Narbonne and Limoux. And Limoux is up in the mountains and very mystical. This is really the cradle of European wine outside of Greece and outside of Georgia, because the Phoenicians and the Greeks landed between Marseille and Barcelona. They hit the far end of the world, as they thought it, as they crossed the Mediterranean, and they hit into this Eden-like land full of beautiful rivers, forests filled with great-looking sort of beasts and animals, and they planted vines all over these 3,000 years ago. So they've been making wine in this region for a very long time. It's also where Joseph of Arimathea is alleged to have brought Jesus and Mary and Mary Magdalene, according to the cult of the Cathars and also Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code.
Yes,
so
indeed.
Obviously, clearly true.
Yeah.
This is a beautiful Chardonnay.
Well, the Cathars are fairly serious about it, given what happened to them.
Yeah, the Cathars are very serious about it, and they walk the walk and talk to the talk. Yeah. This is Chardonnay from a high region again, so it's kind of cool. So every time you go up in the mountains, you cool down. So even though it's very far down, very south in Mediterranean, and hot days, you know, 30 degrees, 31 degrees centigrade, all throughout the summer, constant sun. But if you go up a few hundred feet into the air, obviously, you get cooler very quickly. So the Limoux vineyards are right up at the top of this, and so they have the Chardonnay there that they're able to replicate, not match, but replicate the idea, the taste profile, and the interest of Burgundy Chardonnay. So the Chardonnays are much further north, and this is a really succulent, rather good and generously toned and textured wine, organically made, barrel fermented. And, you know, doing all of the things you expect from something very, very high priced, but in fact has been nicely snagged by Aldi.
It's very nice,
lovely wine.
Given that, you know, it's always an interesting thing, given the price disparity between the two wines,
yes.
Is the M&S wine twice as good as the Aldi wine?
No. I'm
saying it, you don't have to. Right, we'll move on to our second movie of the day. It is Breathe. Here's a clip.
Where do you think you're going?
We're taking my husband home.
You don't have my permission.
There's a prison. You're a prisoner.
What do you think you're doing?
It is the patient's own wish, sir. He's fully apprised of the risks.
Take him back to the ward at once.
Diana, call the police. Tell them I'm being held against my will.
I'm sorry? What did you say?
You have no right to keep me in this place.
Of course. Be my guest.
Let's go.
Do as you please. You'll be dead in 2 weeks.
There you go. That's a clip from Breathe. There. Is there a bang of Fault in Our Stars off this?
Not really. It reminded me more of kind of the film about, I can't remember anything today, sorry. Yes. It reminded me more of another...
Give us a clue. I love this now, because then you can't remember anything about the thing you're trying to remember. Like, you know, he was wearing a blue jumper.
That's exactly where I am right now. Jason, your name is, isn't it?
Yeah, close enough, yeah.
every few years you get a few kind of Oscar baiting type of movies, which are kind of beautifully acted and directed and a very strong story, but it just feels like they're just a bit too austere or elegant or something, and they don't get to the real heart of the film. And I felt this about this one. It just plays it a little too safe, given the risks that the characters who are featured in it take, really, because it's a really potentially really interesting film. Not a bad film at all, though. Perfectly nice to bring your mammy to now for the weekend, and well acted and directed, and very good performances from Andrew Garfield and Claire Foy. But it didn't just quite get to the heart of the spirit of adventure that these people had. And, you know, for a debut from Andy Serkis, who we all love, let's face it, why wouldn't we? I wanted something more. I wanted just something a little bit more. But it's about the story of Robin Cavendish and his wife Diana. So Garfield plays Cavendish, and the Crown's Claire Foy is Diana. And they're kind of this young and adventurous couple with the world at their feet, actually, almost annoyingly middle class and happy in the start of the film, you know. But this is the 1950s where now redundant diseases often destroyed people's lives, and he contracts polio and becomes very quickly critically ill, dependent on an iron lung to survive. And just really, he played cricket, he was very active, he has a young child, and just really can't face into the thought of living with this disease at all, confined to a hospital bed for the rest of his days, looking at, you know, four walls, which is what the medical establishment expected of you during this time. You know, the idea of you going home was inconceivable, or the idea of training, you know, loved ones to be carers was is just not going to happen. So they kind of fought and rallied against all of that. And it tells that kind of story. And she got him home, and they took some real gambles. There's one scene where his plug accidentally gets disconnected by the kid who's just knocking around the house playing. And he very nearly... you know, very nearly is the end of him, like. And so, you know, there is the argument being made is, like, should this man be in hospital? But there is, he just manages to lead a really full life, thanks to a character played by Hugh Vonnebel, who's this kind of mad inventor type friend of his. And they set up this kind of trolley, and they get him mobile, they put the iron lung into it, and off they go on their adventures off to Spain, and take huge risks in the process, which are glossed over a little. And he ended up being a bit of a groundbreaking character in that, you know, the medical establishment was forced to re-examine how they treat people with diseases like this, really. And it was kind of the start of a bit more forward-thinking time.
Okay.
It's all very lovely and nice, but a little bit more forgettable than it should have been, given the story.
Yeah, indeed. One final question for you, Tomás, because it sounds urgent. Declan says, I recently purchased 6 bottles of a Bordeaux wine. Is this my favourite? Tastes slightly of vinegar after the taste, rather than what I'm used to from a Bordeaux. Smells perfect. Any idea what the reason for this is? The cork was very dry and broke away when opening.
Yeah, I mean, that's that sounds very oxidized. Oxygen hitting alcohol transforms it into balsamic vinegar. All wine is heading towards balsamic vinegar in the end, if it's not stored well or if the cork isn't good seal.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So, sorry about that, Declan. Right, thanks. Of course, sorry for taking me giving you bad news. Thanks to Tomás and Esther. Neva's here to tell us about some good things to do this weekend.
There is some bang of wine in here. We just walked through the door. Cork, there's the Jazz Festival happening in Cork. It's its 40th edition. There's 1,000 musicians and hundreds of sessions. So if you don't bang into a jazz musician in Cork, there's something wrong. So that's all weekend. GuinnessJazzFestival.com for all the info. Galway, if you're in Galway, the world famous Mochness Parade is happening. It's Port Nabucchi. It pushes its way through Galway City Centre's Latin Quarter on Sunday the 29th at 5:30 p.m. And it's celebrating the wonderful spirit of the West of Ireland. And don't fret, because if you're in the capital, there's another parade the following day, and it's starting in Moore Street as part of the Bram Stoker Festival at 5:30. And for the little ones, there's a great Dracula's Disco happening in the Ark. Are hosting it. It's going to be in the Meeting House Square. It's going to be outdoors, so obviously dress accordingly. It's 2 to 4 p.m. Dress accordingly, and first come first served. It's free, arc.ie for all the events on that one.
Good stuff. Thanks very much, Niamh. Our production team today, Niamh Hassel, Claire Collins, Michael Quilligan, Anne-Marie Kane and Elaine Power. Ivan's up next. No doubt he'll be looking in some detail at that Catalan vote. We'll talk to you on Monday. Have a nice weekend.
Moncrief on News Talk.
With Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. Gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.